Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. John Rutten pulled into the garage of his condo in Van Nuys, California, around 6 p.m. on Monday, February 24, 1986, and immediately knew something was wrong. The garage door was standing open. He and his wife, Sherry, always closed it. And her silver BMW, the two-door they had bought for her in lieu of an engagement ring less than a year earlier, was gone. Scenarios began running through John's mind. Sherry had stayed home sick that day. Maybe she had changed her mind? She'd been sort of borderline about it, saying her back was sore and she was a bit run down. But she was also scheduled to give a motivational training session at work, so maybe she had rallied and gone in after all? She'd still been in bed when he left at 7:20 a.m. He had tried calling her throughout the day, but there was never an answer, which would support the "she went to work after all" theory. But the odd thing was, the couple's answering machine had never picked up, so he hadn't been able to leave a message. They always turned it on when they left the condo empty. John climbed out of his car into the garage. Broken glass littered the pavement. After he entered the condo through the back door, the door he and Sherry always used, not the front door they only use for guests, he spotted a bloody handprint on the wall. Then he noticed the front door was unlocked. Just inside the door, stereo equipment, a VCR, a CD player, speakers, sat stacked in a pile. The living room looked like a bomb had gone off. A gray ceramic vase lay shattered on the floor. And there, on the living room floor, in a pool of blood, lay his wife of just 3 months. Sherry Rasmussen was 29 years old. She'd always been so full of promise. And this was a woman who had skipped 2 grades in school and become a registered nurse at age 20. By 27, she was director of critical care nursing at Glendale Adventist Medical Center, where she lectured medical students on topics like artificial pacemakers and higher nursing education standards. She had earned a master's degree from UCLA. She told her father she was going to elevate the stature of nursing in the nation, and everyone who knew her believed she would do it. It was exactly the type of thing someone as driven and accomplished as Sherry seemed destined to pull off. John stared at her body in disbelief. He felt for a pulse, but he knew before he even touched her, the effort would be in vain. He wasn't medically trained like she was, but he could tell she wasn't breathing and hadn't been for quite some time. As he suspected, her body was cold to the touch. The crime scene told a brutal story. Sherry had been beaten badly. Her right eye was swollen and blackened, and her face was caked in blood. John couldn't stomach seeing her that way, so he grabbed a hand towel and covered her face as he fetched the phone to dial 911. He was too distraught to make sense of the scene, but the first detectives to arrive started piecing things together, and Sherry had fought for her life in a violent struggle. 2 of her fingernails had been ripped off. On the inside of her left forearm was a bite mark. The broken vase had been smashed over her head. Bloodied cords suggested her attacker had tried to bind her wrists, but failed. To finally subdue Sherry, her assailant resorted to a gun, shooting her 3 times at point-blank range, using a quilted blanket to muffle the 2nd and 3rd shots. Upstairs, the glass sliding door to the balcony was shattered. 2 more bullet holes punched through it, as if the fight had started up there and moved downstairs. Los Angeles Police Detective Lyle Mayer estimated the attack had lasted an astounding 45 minutes. Surveying the scene, he quickly formed a theory. Sherry had interrupted a burglary in progress. The stacked electronics, the missing BMW, the front door, it all fit. Mayer told John that night he believed two men had broken in sometime before 10 a.m., thinking the place was empty and planning to steal valuables. Sherry had heard a ruckus from an upstairs floor and had walked in on them. Things had gone horribly wrong. Not everyone who knew Sherry thought that theory made a ton of sense. And why would burglars leave the stuff they had supposedly set out to burgle? Nothing of monetary value was missing from the condo outside of Sherry's car, which Mayer thought was stolen only out of convenience. But Mayer's theory got a boost 6 weeks later when a woman just down the street surprised two men burglarizing her condo. One pulled a gun on her, but luckily didn't use it. "See," Mayer said, "same neighborhood, same M.O. Did he know his stuff or what?" But if Detective Mayer was right, if Sherry Rasmussen really did die in a random burglary gone wrong, then this case wouldn't belong on Crimes of the Centuries. Yet here we are. Not because of the crime itself, the one that happened February 24th, 1986, but what didn't happen for the next 23 years. Sherry Rasmussen grew up in a world where excellence wasn't just expected, it was assumed. Born February 7, 1957, in Walla Walla, Washington, she was raised in Arizona as the middle daughter of three girls. Her father, Nels, was a well-to-do dentist. He and Sherry's mother, Loretta, ran his dental practice together. From the start, Sherry was a lot, in the best way, but still a lot. She was one of those kids who made other parents feel inadequate. In kindergarten, her teacher used her as an assistant because Sherry was already working at a level beyond her classmates, and things never changed throughout her schooling. She grew to be tall, athletic, driven, and so focused it could be intimidating. Again, she skipped two grades. And yet, she was also a bit of a goofball. Here's her sister, Connie, talking to 2020.
She was the middle sister, and she was a clown. If everything got too serious, she would make everybody laugh.
The Rasmussens were Seventh-day Adventists, which meant Sherry attended Thunderbird Adventist Academy. At 16, she graduated high school and enrolled at La Sierra University, a Seventh-day Adventist school in Southern California. After her freshman year, she transferred to Loma Linda University's nursing program, another Adventist institution with one of the top nursing schools in the country.
She had certainly an interest in caring for other people.
Nursing wasn't just a career choice for Sherry. It was a calling. She had an easy bedside manner with an infectious smile, and she really knew her stuff. In school, she excelled in classes that stymied classmates even years older. She wasn't just interested in being good at her job. She wanted to change the whole field. And she was well on her way. After graduating from Loma Linda, Sherry worked at UCLA Medical Center's coronary care unit while simultaneously pursuing her master's degree. She earned it in 1980 when she was just 23. UCLA promoted her to head nurse and appointed her an unpaid assistant clinical professor teaching medical students, despite barely being older than they were. Her father, Nels, was immensely proud, but also worried. His daughter was this tall, beautiful, brilliant woman working late hours in a notoriously dangerous city. So, he bought her a condo in Van Nuys in a gated complex with a drive-in garage so she wouldn't have to walk along the street after late shifts. Sherry paid him rent equal to his mortgage payment. She valued her independence, after all. By early 1984, Sherry had landed a job as director of critical care nursing at Glendale Adventist Medical Center, a major step up at just 27 years old. She loved the people, loved the place, loved her profession. She was exactly where she wanted to be. Now, during school, Sherry had backburnered relationships in favor of studying. Really, there's no alternative if you want to graduate with your master's degree by 23. But now that her career felt stable and she was nearing her late 20s, she started thinking about pursuing a family as well as a career. That's where she was in June 1984 when she happened to go to a party where she met an engineer named John Rutten. John was a UCLA graduate like Sherry. He'd studied electrical engineering and had just started a new job at Micropolis, a computer company. He was handsome, smart, ambitious. By all accounts, Sherry was immediately smitten. They started dating shortly after that party. So what drew Sherry to John? Well, friends said she appreciated his steadiness, his calm demeanor. Where Sherry was all energy and ambition, John seemed content to let life unfold at its own pace. He was smart without being competitive about it, comfortable in his own skin. After years of operating at full throttle, school, career, constant striving, maybe Sherry found his laid-back nature appealing. He didn't need her to be on all the time. And John seemed genuinely impressed by Sherry's accomplishments. He listened when she talked about her work, asked questions about her patience, and seemed to take her career seriously. More than that, though, he liked the fun side of her. For a woman who had spent her entire life proving herself, having someone to just hang out with and have a good time must have felt like a relief. Her family wasn't quite as enthusiastic. Nels and Loretta found John pleasant enough, not rude, not problematic, just not right for their daughter. They couldn't put their finger on exactly what bothered them, but something about the match felt off. And John seemed too aloof for a young woman who had always seemed to be operating on hyperdrive. Some of Sherry's friends felt similarly. The couple double-dated with Jane, one of Sherry's closest friends, to the opening ceremonies of the Olympics when they were held in Los Angeles. This was in the summer of 1984, right after John and Sherry started dating. Jane later told author Matthew McGough that after a long, hot day of festivities, the foursome just wanted to get on a bus to get back home. Sherry spotted the right bus and led them there, but John spotted another one and said, "No, let's take this one." Of course, that other bus didn't go where they needed it to go, and the one that did, the one Sherry had literally stepped onto before John convinced her to step off, had already left. So they had to wait an hour in the heat for the next bus. Jane was not a fan of John's after that. She tolerated him for Sherry's sake, of course, but she saw this moment as telling. He couldn't seem to let Sherry take the lead. He had to put his two cents in, even though he led them all astray. And worse, he never apologized for it. He just made lame jokes while they all awaited the next bus. But Sherry didn't seem to see that. She saw John as the ballast she needed. She told her family that in John, she had found exactly what she had been looking for. The courtship moved quickly. They were both athletic, so they ran together and hiked and played tennis. Sherry had always been close with her parents, calling them regularly and confiding in them, especially her father, Nels. He could tell that his daughter saw far more in John than he did, so he kept his reservations to himself. He routinely invited John to family gatherings, including Christmases back in Tucson and trips aboard Nels' rotating cast of boats. After about a year of dating, John proposed. He and Sherry decided an engagement ring was as showy as it was impractical, so instead of a ring, they got Sherry a sporty BMW. Even as a professional 28-year-old, Sherry worried about what her parents thought, so she basically asked permission for John to move into her condo before the wedding. You know, living in sin and all that. Her father still owned the place, the same one he had bought to keep her safe, though Sherry had covered the mortgage payments herself. She explained to her folks that it just didn't make financial sense for John to live somewhere else when they were about to get married anyway. Nels and Loretta agreed, and Nels transferred the property into the couple's names. They got married November 23, 1985, in what friends described as a beautiful ceremony. Sherry was 28, John was 26. They honeymooned, came back, celebrated Christmas as newlyweds, and settled into the condo together. Everything was falling into place. The career, the husband, the future. Then, 3 months after the wedding, that future was over.
A woman brutally murdered in cold blood.
Instead of planning next steps in her career or talking children with her new husband, Sherry was laid to rest in Tucson. In the days immediately after Sherry Rasmussen's murder, Detective Lyle Mayer worked the case with the confidence of someone who had seen it all before. And in 1986 Los Angeles, he had. The city was drowning in violent crime. 831 homicides that year alone. Street crime was spiking. Gang violence was everywhere. The LAPD was stretched thin, overworked, and operating in a different era of policing. So when Mayer looked at the Rasmussen crime scene, the stacked electronics, the missing BMW, he saw what he expected to see. A burglary gone bad, open and shut. He figured the burglars had entered through the condo's front door, which John and Sherry rarely used. They had had friends over the day before the murder, and John couldn't say with certainty that they locked the front door after the guests left. Even though the condo community was gated, too, Mayer figured someone got past the main gate and simply walked in the Ruttons' front door. It all culminated in a shooting. From True Crime Documentary.
Two bullets of .38 caliber were recovered from Sherry's body. Each of these shots would have been lethal within a very short time frame. It was clear someone intended to ensure her death.
Sherry's co-workers couldn't believe she had met such a violent end. Former colleague Paul Scott told a reporter there was
a lot of shock. Nobody could believe it had happened to one of our nursing directors.
They quickly arranged a memorial service in Sherry's honor and assumed they would be contacted by the police. Very few of them actually were, and those who did get calls felt like the police weren't interested in anything they had to say. Now, Mayer did talk at length to John Rutten, whom he handled delicately. The newlywed was understandably emotional, devastated, clearly in shock. Mayer questioned him the night of the murder and quickly ruled him out as a suspect. John had an alibi. He had been at work at Macropolis all day and picked up dry cleaning on his drive home, for which he had the receipt. The timeline didn't work for him to have done this. Mayer even told John directly that he was a good judge of character and was fairly certain John had nothing to do with his wife's death. Which, to be fair to Detective Mayer, was true. John Rutten didn't kill his wife. That didn't stop Mayer from giving John a polygraph, though, twice. Both times, Rutten's responses were inconclusive. The polygrapher administering the test said he was so emotional answering the questions that it was possible the test couldn't read deception like it was designed to. But Mayer's gut didn't waver when it came to John, and John's alibi was rock solid anyway, so Mayer moved forward with the investigation. During a crime scene walkthrough within days of the murder, Mayer asked John some standard questions. Can you think of anyone who might have wanted to hurt Sherry? Did she have any enemies? John said, no, not really. Though he'd had a friend in college who seemed to be upset he was getting married. I mean, they weren't close or anything, John said. But since you asked, her name was Stephanie Lazarus. John said Mayer made a note of it. He asked about her later, and Mayer told him she was a dead end. There was someone else who had caused Sherry trouble too, John added. A woman at the hospital was up for a promotion that Sherry didn't give her. The woman thought the snub was because she was having an affair with a married doctor there, but Sherry just didn't think she was up to snuff for professional reasons. John said the couple got crank calls at the condo afterward that Sherry was sure were related. As with the ex, Mayer later told John he had checked it out, and it was nothing. The burglary angle was the only viable path. Sherry's parents didn't think so. Nels and Loretta Rasmussen learned of their daughter's death the morning after it happened, and not from John, which bothered them. They got a call from John's father, Richard, on February 25th. John had called his own parents, but no one from Sherry's family. Nels and Loretta immediately traveled to Los Angeles, where they met Teresa, Sherry's pregnant sister. All three of them told Mayer that while the burglary angle was possible, Sherry had been having real problems with a couple of people, the slighted coworker and John's ex-girlfriend, whose name they didn't know. Sherry had told them a lot about her, they said, but not her name. In early February 1986, just before her murder, Sherry had visited her parents in Tucson for her birthday. While they were there, Nels had actually tried to convince her and John to move to Arizona, promising he could get John an engineering position through connections. Sherry wasn't sold on the idea, but during that visit, she had confided something disturbing to her father when John wasn't within earshot. She told him she was being followed, stalked, by someone dressed, quote, like a boy, end quote. And the way she worded it suggested that she suspected it was a woman in male clothing, but she didn't say that outright. She said there were times she was driving her BMW and felt like she was being followed. Other times, she would be at dinner, sometimes with John, and she would spot the person watching them eat. Separate from that, she had confided in her dad several times about John's ex-girlfriend. She told them that before the wedding, while Sherry and John were engaged, a provocatively dressed woman had shown up at her office at Glendale Adventist. A colleague, Sherry's assistant, later confirmed it. A woman had come to the hospital, found Sherry, and confronted her about John. The assistant said Sherry was crying when she reemerged from her office, and Sherry told her that the woman had said, "If I can't have John, no one can." Sherry told her parents this tale too, though she left out a key detail from the encounter. More on that in a minute. Still, the wedding went on as planned in November 1985. Afterward, the harassment continued. Sherry told her parents that the ex had stopped by the condo uninvited with skis she wanted John to wax. Sherry was naturally uncomfortable with this, but she said John told her it would be best not to get confrontational. He waxed the skis and returned them, she told her parents. Then, one weekday in January 1986, so just a month before the murder, Sherry called her parents in tears with a harrowing story. As Matthew McGough wrote in a book about the case, Sherry said she was home later in the morning than usual. The condo was split in three levels, with the living room on the lowest floor, a kitchen area on the second, and the bedrooms on the third. Sherry came downstairs and, from the kitchen level, could see John's ex-girlfriend standing in their living room. She hadn't even knocked, she was just there. Sherry told the woman to leave, and she did, but Sherry told her parents through tears that John was too weak-willed to tell the woman to stay the hell out of their lives. This was not how Sherry expected her new life as a married woman to begin. Now, as Nels and Loretta grappled with the gut-wrenching news of their daughter's murder, they told Detective Mayer about these encounters. Mayer's response, according to Nels, was dismissive. He told him, quote, "You've been watching too much TV," end quote. The investigation moved forward with the burglary theory locked in place. The BMW was found about a week later, parked on a nearby street with the keys still in the ignition, not stripped for parts or used in any other crime, just abandoned. The only other thing missing from the condo, besides the car, was the couple's marriage certificate. And Sherry's jewelry sat untouched on her dresser. The couple's other valuables were unmolested. The only indicators pointing to an interrupted burglary were the stack of electronics not stolen by the front door and the missing car, which had been quickly abandoned. Nels asked Mayer, "What kind of burglar fights with a woman for, according to your estimate, 45 minutes and only steals a marriage certificate?" But 6 weeks after Sherry's murder, another burglary happened in the same Van Nuys neighborhood. Two armed men, a woman surprised them in her home, and one of them pulled out a .38 caliber gun, the same caliber that killed Sherry. To Mayer, this confirmed everything. Sherry Rasmussen had been killed by burglars. Case closed. Now, they just needed to find the suspects. The second burglary victim had described two Hispanic men as her assailants. She worked with a police artist to create sketches that were released on the news and in papers as suspects in Sherry Rasmussen's murder. No one called in any tips. The investigation had barely started, and it was already going cold. Mayer and his partner, Detective Steve Hooks, worked it for a while, but they had dozens of other cases. The leads dried up. Now, in homicide investigations, the LAPD kept what's called a murder book for every case. Every shred of investigative material is supposed to be stored in that book. Every tip called in, every lead chased, every contact with lab techs, all of it. According to the murder book, John's ex, Stephanie Lazarus, was not only never interviewed, but she was never even contacted. Her name only appeared once in the whole book, and that was in a hand-scrawled note 18 months after the murder, when John apparently called to confirm her name to the police. The note simply read, John Rutten called, verified Stephanie Lazarus, P/O, was former girlfriend. 8 months after Sherry's death, the Rasmussens offered a $10,000 reward for information. Nothing came of it. In 1988, Nels reached out to true crime writer Ann Rule. You probably know her work. She wrote The Stranger Beside Me about Ted Bundy, hoping she might write about Sherry's case and generate some attention. Rule seemed interested. Nels told her about the Lazarus angle. A few days later, Rule called back and said she couldn't do it. According to Nels, she told the family that she had an investigator with an in at the LAPD, and after she discussed the case with him, she decided to skip it. Mayer retired in 1991. Hooks was reassigned. The new detective assigned to the case told Nels Rasmussen that he agreed with Mayer. This was a burglary gone wrong that likely would never be solved. When Nels offered to pay for DNA testing around 1993, the technology was finally available then, he was told it'd be useless. The police needed to have a suspect first before they could test anything. So the case sat and sat and sat. For more than two decades, it looked like Sherry Rasmussen's murder would never be solved. The case file sat in storage, gathering dust. Her parents aged, grieved, and wondered if they would ever get answers. But then, in the early 2000s, something changed. The LAPD formed a dedicated cold case unit, and advances in DNA technology and nationwide databases were revolutionizing forensic investigation. In 2003, a detective named Cliff Shepard pulled Sherry Rasmussen's file. He saw blood had been collected back in 1986. DNA testing in 86 wasn't sophisticated enough to do much with it, but now they could extract a profile. Shepard requested the DNA analysis. A year later, in 2004, because things move at a glacial pace in law enforcement, a criminologist named Jennifer Francis finally started to do the testing. But all of the blood samples from the crime scene came back to Sherry's DNA profile. So Francis looked for other evidence to test. Pretty much all of the physical evidence had disappeared from the case file. All the fingernail clippings and hair strands, all of that stuff was all missing without explanation. It had just vanished in the 18 years since the murder. But there was one item that wasn't stored with that other stuff, a swab from the bite mark the killer had left on Sherry's arm. It took Francis some real digging, but she eventually located that singular swab and tested it for DNA. When the test came back, she was floored. The bite mark had been made by a woman. Francis sent the result to Shepard, who ran the DNA through CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System, the national database, and got no match. Francis looked back through the case file for any mention of a female suspect. There wasn't much. The mention of Stephanie Lazarus had been so brief, in fact, that she had missed it despite having spent hours perusing the murder book. Still, to Francis, the murder felt personal. A long, drawn-out fight and close enough contact for the attacker to bite the victim? She circled back to Shepard and asked about the status. He said he was looking for male-female burglar duos known to have worked L.A. in the 1980s. Francis was floored. Still with this burglary-gone-bad theory? Wasn't it possible that the motive was more personal than that? Shepard seemed annoyed by the question. The case languished for 5 more years. Until February 2, 2009, when the file mysteriously ended up next to the desk of a Van Nuys homicide detective named Jim Nuttall. It took months before Nuttall cracked the murder book, but once he did, he began to question everything Detective Mayer had done in the case. He called Jennifer Francis, who almost immediately said, quote, "I'm not telling you how to do your job, but I don't think this was a burglary," end quote. Nuttall had been thinking the same thing. He placed a couple of phone calls to friends and to Sherry's parents, and all said exactly what Francis had. This was no robbery. Nuttall called John Rutten and asked about the ex-girlfriend mentioned in the murder book. "Yeah," John said, "I was involved in a years-long on-and-off relationship with Stephanie Lazarus." He said as far as he knew, she still worked the same job she had had back then. "Oh yeah?" Nuttall asked. "What job's that?" John said, "Well, you should know. She was a Los Angeles police cop." Nuttall looked again at the one mention of Lazarus in the murder book. Stephanie Lazarus, P/O. The detective hadn't realized what the P/O meant. It was shorthand for police officer. Lazarus was indeed still on the force. She had joined 3 years before Sherry's murder and had moved up the ranks to Detective 2. For the past several years, she had worked art theft detail, a high-profile position that landed her on TV and in newspapers fairly often. Detective Nuttall realized the case was going to be far more complicated than he had realized. Hey everyone, before we get back to the show, just a reminder that you can get bonus episodes and bonus material at grabbagcollab.com. Just go to grabbagcollab.com and choose which tier you'd like to subscribe to. Thanks so much. Stephanie Lazarus and John Rutten met at UCLA in the late 1970s. They were both students living in the dorms and, according to John's later testimony at trial, they became friends. At some point, the kind with benefits. John was very clear about this, both at trial and in interviews with investigators. He never considered Stephanie his girlfriend. They had a casual relationship that involved hooking up occasionally. It was friendly, it was physical, but it wasn't serious, at least not to him. Stephanie, however, saw things very differently. She was born in 1960, meaning she was 3 years younger than Sherry and grew up wanting to be a police officer. After graduating from UCLA, she went straight to the police academy and joined the LAPD in 1983. From what anyone could tell, Stephanie was a decent patrol officer. Not exceptional, just solid. She would get commendations here and there for keeping detailed call logs and her professionalism. Early in her career, she kept a journal describing her shifts. Her commendation letters might have read a little bit differently if her supervisors had read them. She ran personal errands on the clock, took naps, got free meals because she was a cop. She would call citizens disgusting and refer to Asian people as Orientals. She mentioned John occasionally, but never wrote about visiting his condo uninvited or asking him to wax her skis. She never mentioned Sherry either, even in passing, as the murdered wife of a once good friend. The omission is telling, because the fact is, when John got engaged to Sherry, Stephanie's reaction was intense. She wrote a letter to John's mother, quote, "I'm truly in love with John, and the past year has really torn me up. I wish it didn't end the way it did, and I don't think I'll ever understand his decision," end quote. Soon after that letter, Stephanie called John and asked him to come over to her house. He went. She cried and confessed her love for him. And John slept with her. He would later testify that it was a mistake, that it didn't change anything between him and Sherry, that he still wanted to marry Sherry. But the damage was done. Stephanie now knew that even after John had chosen Sherry, even after he had proposed to someone else, she could still get him to come back, even if for just one night. And she made sure Sherry knew it too. Here's John Taylor, the Rasmussen's lawyer, talking in an Associated Press video.
They told of times when Stephanie Lazarus appeared at Sherry Rasmussen's place of work at Glendale Adventist and told Sherry Rasmussen, "If I cannot have John, nobody can."
I had mentioned this earlier, the work confrontation that Sherry told her parents about. What she didn't tell them was that Stephanie told her she had slept with John. Now, Sherry did confront John with this. He apologized, said he'd felt sorry for the woman and was weak. It had meant nothing to him. Sherry agreed to move past it and, likely out of embarrassment, never told her parents, who surely would have questioned whether John was good husband material after all. Maybe they had a point. A man who can't tell his ex to, you know, not illegally enter his home and harass his girlfriend slash wife doesn't seem like husband material to me either. It's hard to know why he couldn't muster the courage. Maybe he was scared of Stephanie, or maybe he wasn't at all, but should have been. This is Joshua Ritter, a former LA prosecutor.
This was a crime not of what we consider usually passion, but a crime of planning and deliberation. I mean, she stalked her victim. She planned it. This was an execution-style killing.
As a cop, Stephanie Lazarus understood crime scenes. She knew what detectives looked for, what made a case solvable, what made evidence useful or useless. She had been on patrol for 3 years by the time Sherry was murdered. She had seen burglaries, talked to victims, watched how her fellow officers processed scenes. She knew exactly what a burglary was supposed to look like. And when new detectives re-examined the crime scene decades later, it became obvious that's exactly what she'd done. She staged it. The gun used to kill Sherry was a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson. When investigators finally started looking into Stephanie Lazarus, they discovered something interesting. After graduating from the police academy, Stephanie had bought a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson as a backup weapon. And just a few weeks after Sherry's murder, Stephanie filed a report saying her .38 had been stolen. And she didn't file that report with the LAPD, where she worked. She filed it in Santa Monica. Different jurisdiction, less likely to raise questions. LAPD rules called for her to report it stolen to them, too, but she never did. As author Matthew McGough once said in an interview, after the homicide, Stephanie's career was on a steady incline.
She worked as a police officer. She made detectives. She later worked in internal affairs. She worked performing background checks of civilian applicants to the LAPD. She worked homicide at Van Nuys Homicide.
That's right. She worked homicide in the very department where Sherry's murder was languishing as a cold case. That meant she had ample access to the murder book containing all the evidence collected, which is noteworthy because when detectives went back through the files in 2009, they found inconsistencies. Interviews that should have been in the murder book weren't there. Notes that had been referenced were missing. Plus, there was all of that physical evidence that had disappeared. Everything but the bite mark swab, which happened to be stored in a separate place that took serious digging for criminologist Jennifer Francis to find. Now, we know Nels Rasmussen and John Rutten both asked Detective Mayer to look into Stephanie Lazarus because they said they did. In fact, Rasmussen brought up Lazarus to Detective Nuttall straight away, meaning she had been front and center on his mind for more than two decades. Yet when Mayer was interviewed in 2009, he claimed that neither man, or anyone else for that matter, had ever mentioned Stephanie's name. And we don't know precisely what happened in that condo, but here's what we do know. Stephanie Lazarus, armed with her knowledge of how crime scenes worked and what investigators looked for, drove to Sherry and John's condo on the morning of February 24th, 1986. It was a Monday, Stephanie had taken the day off work. Sherry had called in sick. Stephanie brought a gun. Whether she walked in planning on killing Sherry is a mystery, but a battle most definitely ensued. At one point, based on the ligature marks on Sherry's wrists and thin bloody cord found at the scene, Stephanie tied her up. Sherry fought like mad. She might have gotten Stephanie in a headlock at one point, which might have been why Stephanie bit her in the arm. Regardless, that bite was deep and hard. Stephanie ended up with the upper hand. She smashed the ceramic vase over Sherry's head. Sherry went down. And then Stephanie shot her once in the chest. Then she grabbed a nearby quilted blanket, which had been a gift from Sherry's grandmother, no less, wrapped it around the gun to muffle the sound, and shot Sherry twice more, point blank. Next, she staged the scene, stacked the electronics, took the BMW and the marriage certificate, made it look like a burglary. And then she went back to her life, and nobody stopped her for 23 years. Detective Jim Nuttall and his partner, Pete Barba, had to make tough decisions about the Sherry Rasmussen case as soon as they learned a fellow officer might be involved. Knowing that Lazarus could check the case status at any point, they created a new file number and logged encrypted updates within it. Instead of referring to Lazarus by her name, they called her number 5, as in she was the 5th of 5 females they aimed to eliminate as the source of the female DNA discovered on Sherry's body. The first 3 were family members who were quickly knocked off the list. No one in Sherry's close orbit had any motive to hurt her. The last 2 were the women Nels Rasmussen had told Detective Mayer about 2 decades earlier, the co-worker Sherry didn't promote, and number 5, Stephanie Lazarus, John's ex-girlfriend. Nuttall and Barba were joined by 2 more detectives who also roped in criminologist Francis. They managed to get a DNA sample from the woman passed over on the promotion, no match. That left securing Lazarus's DNA. To do that, they had to rope in the LAPD's Robbery Homicide Division. On a day when Stephanie was off duty, detectives followed her to a Costco in Simi Valley. She was shopping, just doing normal errands. At some point, she bought a drink with a straw. When she was done, she threw both the cup and straw away. Detectives retrieved them from the trash. They sent the items to the lab for DNA analysis. And in late 2008, the results came back. It was a match. They had their killer. But they still had to be careful. Stephanie Lazarus was a detective with more than 2 decades of experience. She knew how interrogations worked, knew her rights, knew how to handle police questioning. If they were going to get anything useful from her, they had to play it smart. On June 5th, 2009, detectives lured Stephanie into an interrogation room to supposedly chat with someone claiming they had info about an art theft. Instead, once inside the room, Stephanie learned she was being asked some quote-unquote routine questions about a cold case. They began asking her what she remembered about John Rutten. Everything she said was recorded.
Do you know John Rutten?
John Rutten? John Rutten?
Rutten.
Right. Oh, yeah, I went to school with him.
You did?
Yeah.
How long did you know him?
Gosh, I went to school in, let's see, went to 1978 I started and, you know, met him at school at the dorms.
Mm-hmm. Were you guys friends, close friends?
Yeah, we were very close friends.
Yeah?
I mean, what's this all about?
The detectives eased into the questions. So how close were you?
I know his sister, his brother, his sister, I know, stayed at my townhouse a number of times. I couldn't tell you how many times.
Right.
The detectives pushed a little harder.
Were you guys just friends or anything else? Or?
Yeah, we were good friends.
Yeah. Was there ever any relationship or anything that developed between you guys?
Yeah, I mean, we dated. You know, I mean, what's this all about?
Well, it's relating to his wife.
Okay.
Okay. Did you know her?
Not really. I mean, I knew that he got married years ago.
Uh-huh. Did you ever meet her?
God, I don't know.
Do you know who she was or anything?
Well, let me think. God, it's been a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I may have met her. Geez. You know.
Yeah. Well, let me see. Let me ask you. You said you dated John. How long did you guys date?
I mean, what are you guys? Is this something? I mean, you said I was going to interview somebody about art, and how you guys are.
Here's.
I mean,
you can hear her getting rattled. The detectives quickly explain, "Look, your name's in the chronology detailing the Rasmussen investigation, so of course we have to ask some basic questions of you. And we brought you into this here private room because you're one of us, and we wanted to afford you privacy that we don't always give the peons of the world." At this point, Stephanie had been married to a fellow cop named Scott Young for about 13 years, so they also used that as an excuse. "You're married to one of us, so we don't want your business leaking all over the department." Stephanie calmed down and actually thanked them. She continued answering questions. She said that John would pester her even when they were in off periods of their on and off relationship. And come to think of it, she did talk to Sherry in person about that once. Or twice, or maybe more.
And I'm like, you know what, why are you calling me if you're either dating her or living with her or married to her? Because I honestly don't remember the time frame. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, come on, knock it off. And I'm thinking I may have gone to her and say, hey, you know what, is he dating you? He's bothering me. And so I'm thinking that we had a conversation about that. One or two, maybe. It could have been three. I don't want to say I had three conversations with her.
At her work or at their house or?
No, I'm thinking that he obviously must have told me where she worked. I'm thinking it was a hospital somewhere.
It was a pretty clever explanation for why she visited Sherry at work. I went to talk to her because her boyfriend wouldn't leave me alone, not because I was obsessed with her boyfriend. The detectives finally told Stephanie why they were really talking to her. They said they had been interviewing some people, and those people said she and Sherry had gotten into a fight at some point. This finally ruffled Stephanie, who said,
"If you guys are claiming that I'm a suspect, then, you know, I got a problem with, you know, with that."
Okay.
So, you know, if you're doing this as an interrogation, you're saying, hey, I'm a suspect. Well, now I got a problem with, you know, now you're accusing me of this. Is that what you're saying?
She said she wanted a lawyer and left the room. The detectives already had a warrant for her arrest. You can hear her reaction here.
This is absolutely crazy.
Okay. Stephanie, you know you have the right to remain silent. Do you understand?
Yes.
Anything you say may be used against you in court. Do you understand?
Yes.
She wasn't happy about it. The first-degree murder trial began in February 2012, 26 years after the homicide. Stephanie was 51 years old. She had been out on bail awaiting trial, and during that time, she had tried every possible legal angle to get the case dismissed. Her attorneys argued that the DNA evidence was too old, potentially contaminated, that the chain of custody was broken. They argued that the swab tube had been stored improperly. None of it worked. During the trial, Stephanie's defense team tried to argue that the crime scene actually did look like a burglary. They pointed to other break-ins in the area. They brought in a forensic dentist who said he couldn't definitively match Stephanie's teeth to the bite mark, though the DNA had already done that job. They argued that Stephanie had made no attempt to contact John immediately after Sherry's death. Wouldn't she have if she'd been obsessed with him enough to kill his wife? John Rutten testified. He described his relationship with Stephanie and said, actually, 1986 wasn't the last time he had seen her. About 3 years after Sherry's murder, he had reached out to her. She had been his good friend, after all, one of his best for years of his life. And Detective Mayer had assured him she had nothing to do with Sherry's death. He not only hung out with Stephanie a few times in the late 80s and early 90s, but he had slept with her again, too. Here's McGough with quite the understatement.
That's sort of a difficult thing to wrap your head around, that he in fact had sex with his wife's killer unwittingly.
But if Stephanie had thought getting Sherry out of the picture would lead to some happily ever after for her and John, she was wrong. They both met other people they liked better and married them. Their relationship was finally off again for good. By the time of the trial, they hadn't seen each other in about 20 years. On March 8, 2012, the jury came back with a verdict, guilty of first-degree murder. It was bittersweet for the Rasmussens on a lot of levels, said their lawyer, John Taylor.
The family has nothing but praise for the LAPD of 2009. The investigation in 1986 is a completely different story, and the family has numerous questions about what was done during that time period.
Stephanie Lazarus was sentenced to 27 years to life in prison. She would be eligible for parole in 2039 when she would be 79 years old. At sentencing, John said, quote, "The fact that Sherry's death occurred because she met me and married me brings me to my knees," end quote. But the story doesn't quite end there. In the 2020s, California passed a law giving special parole consideration to people who committed crimes when they were under 26 years old. Stephanie Lazarus was 25 when she murdered Sherry Rasmussen. She became eligible for early parole consideration. To qualify, she finally admitted during a parole hearing in November 2023 that she had killed Sherry. After years of denying everything, maintaining her innocence through the arrest and trial and appeals, she confessed. According to the parole hearing transcript, she said, quote, "It makes me sick to this day that I took an oath to protect and serve people, and I took Sherry Rasmussen's life from her, a nurse," end quote. But she insisted the killing was in self-defense. Sherry had attacked her, she said. And in the struggle, Lazarus's backup weapon fell out of a fanny pack. Sherry grabbed it, and the two struggled over the weapon. The detectives who reinvestigated the case in 2009 said that defied logic. And besides, if there had been a back-and-forth, life-or-death struggle, why was only Sherry's blood at the crime scene? Still, Lazarus was granted parole in 2023 until it was rescinded after Governor Gavin Newsom ordered a review of the case. He said Lazarus, quote, "evaded justice for more than two decades and did not appear to begin taking full accountability for the murder until she was finally caught," end quote. That's actually generous. She didn't take any accountability until she thought it could get her out of prison early. Lazarus will be eligible again for parole in 2028. Nels and Loretta Rasmussen both lived long enough to see Stephanie Lazarus arrested and convicted. Nels died in 2015. Loretta died in 2019. They got justice for their daughter, finally, but they never got answers about why it took so long, why Detective Mayer ignored their pleas, why evidence went missing from the files. The LAPD has never fully explained what went wrong with the original investigation. Police Chief Charlie Beck issued a statement after Stephanie's conviction, saying the department felt a sense of betrayal that one of their own had committed such a crime and apologizing that it took so long to solve the case. But there's never been a real accounting of why Stephanie Lazarus was protected, whether intentionally or through incompetence, for more than 20 years. To research this case, I read Matthew McGough's exhaustively researched book, The Lazarus Files, A Cold Case Investigation. The level of detail is extraordinary, though fair warning, it is a very dense read. I also read contemporary news coverage and watched Stephanie Lazarus's fascinating interview with police, which you can find in full on YouTube. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.